The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Last time we went over the beginning of John 2, and there we saw Christ perform his first miracle, and he went to Cana for a marriage, and there he changed water into wine. And after this, he went to Capernaum. And let's begin again then and pick this up in John 2, and this time in verse 12. After this, it says, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother, his brethren, and his disciples, and they continued there not many days. Now, Capernaum was a fenced town on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was a great city by comparison to Cana or Nazareth or some of those smaller ones. It was on a trade route, major trade route from Damascus. And so it was called Christ City, actually, at one point. Matthew 9 and verse 1, you can put down for a note there, where it says he entered into a ship and passed over and came to his own city. And that city was Capernaum there. It was called this because it became the center of Christ's Galilean ministry. And he used that city as a base of operations for the most part. And he went here also to fulfill a prophecy. If you go over to Matthew 4 for a moment, we'll read a scripture that verifies this. Matthew 4 and verse 13. Leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the sea coast, in the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea beyond Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people which sat in darkness saw a great light, and to them which sat in the region in shadow of death, light is sprung up. So Christ did many miracles there. Let's go over to Matthew 11. And he spent a lot of time there. He performed a great number of miracles and was well known. And the people, unfortunately, did not respond well to Christ there. And for that reason, he brought a curse on this city. Matthew 11 and verse 23, you'll remember this, and you, Capernaum, which are exalted unto heaven, shall be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which had been done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. So Capernaum has been brought down to the grave, as a matter of fact. That town no longer exists today. Even the site of Capernaum is subject to debate anymore. There's a Tel Hume and a Tel Con Minya both claim to be this site, but neither one can prove it, neither one are sure. So Capernaum has been brought down to the grave because that's where Christ basically headquartered his ministry, mostly worked out of that city, performed all these great miracles there, and yet they rejected Jesus Christ and he performed this curse. And like the fig tree, the same thing has happened to this town. There's a lesson for us in that city. Christ used a headquarters here that we're familiar with, and he worked through it, and yet they didn't fully respond to his message. And as he abandoned that city and it became desolate, I predict that, of course, the headquarters of the Worldwide Church of God will also be abandoned and become desolate. But again, the main message we shouldn't use to focus on others so much as we should focus on ourselves, that God can work through any one of us and through this little group. And yet, if we don't respond to him personally, why then he could also leave us desolate. So it says that his mother and his disciples and brethren also went there. And it seems like Christ went very few places alone. People would follow him wherever he went. He was very magnetic. But he had, remember, in our last time, last Bible study, we saw that he had really separated himself from his mother when he said, "Woman, what have I to do with you?" And he was now moving from being her son to beginning his ministry. And so I really think that the fact that she follows him here is not a fact that she's doing this because she is his mother. I think she's now, after that first miracle that he performed, I think she's following him here now to learn from him a whole different relationship that exists. And of course, as you remember, the Catholic Church teaches that Christ didn't have brothers and sisters. That's part of their teaching of the Immaculate Conception. But here we see that his brethren actually went with him. And so again, this is one more indicator that that doctrine and teaching of theirs is incorrect. So it says that he went there for just a little time, that is to Capernaum, and he went there for a short time, and I think what he did was went there to begin a relationship, because this was going to be the headquarters city from which he would work. But he went there to set up a relationship that he would later continue. Now, one of the reasons why he was only there a short time was because he had to return back to Jerusalem because it was close to the season of Passover. Read this in verse 13. So he went down to Capernaum in verse 13, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and then Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, I think that John says the Jews' Passover for two reasons here. One is this, is that the Jews had changed the Passover ceremony considerably from what was originally instituted. And, of course, in 70 A.D., John was writing this in the 90s, in 70 A.D., the temple was destroyed, the priesthood now no longer existed, so they no longer kept the Passover the way they used to. So the church kept the Passover very different, with the foot washing, with the bread and wine, and the Jews had their own separate Passover, as they do today, where they keep it mostly on the 15th, where they merge the Passover and the first day of unleavened bread together. So I think those are the reasons why John, in retrospect, is saying the Passover of the Jews. So one of the things I want to point out here is, as we go through the book of John, you're going to see something very unique about it, and that is this. He brings up the feasts over and over and over again. And I want you to put this in perspective for a minute, if you would. People teach that the feast or days are no longer to be kept. They teach that all of that was done away. But yet you see in the Synoptic Gospels, you don't see much about the Passover. You see the Passover, I think, one time in the Synoptic Gospels, but you see it a couple of times or more in the Gospel of John, and you see the Feast of Tabernacles, you see another feast that's not given a name. But my point is that if, for instance, the church had done away with the feasts and the church were no longer keeping them, the last gospel written in the 90s, which is like 60 years after Christ has been crucified, that last gospel you think would minimize the feast, wouldn't you? Instead, the opposite is true. Remember, John said specifically he wrote those things that the other gospels left out. Well, with the other gospels, they didn't even think they'd need to mention the feast because it was just understood in the 60s when Matthew wrote. Of course, they wouldn't even mention it because it was understood it was a way of life. But later in the 90s, John does mention it repeatedly as we go through his gospel, when it was Passover, when it was this, when it was that. And we see this, and it's another indicator that he was making sure that the feasts were written down because these things were beginning to weaken in the Church of God by the end of that first century. So, something to notice, something to keep in mind about the Gospel of John. So, one of the things about this, I think, is important where it says that he went up to Jerusalem, Matthew 23, if you will. Christ went to Jerusalem a number of times. He went there infrequently, and I think there's a scripture that reveals this. Matthew 23 and verse 37. Here he says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kills the prophets and stones them which are sent before you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not? But you get the picture here? How often I would have gathered you under my wings. So you get the picture that every time he went by Jerusalem, he looked longingly at the holy city and wanted to be able to heal the people's sadness and their agony and their loneliness and their unhappiness. And yet he could not. He wanted to take them under his wing as a mother would. So I think that shows that he had to have been there many, many times. They're keeping the feast. They're teaching and preaching and warning people. So after Christ's first miracle, he now goes up to the temple. And John shows us then Christ fulfilling prophecy. And here is the story of John that he gives about Jesus Christ cleansing the temple And Christ goes to the temple, and what he finds greatly displeases him. And he immediately takes action. He cleanses the temple of the corruption. I want to put this in the context of him saying it was time for the Jews' Passover. So imagine Christ now going to Jerusalem, going to the temple now during the days that were the days leading up to the days of unleavened bread. Notice how we get all of the leaven out of our homes before Passover. And so imagine this being on Christ's mind as he goes in. This was his father's house. And he goes in, and what does he see? Corruption everywhere. And he cleans his house, his father's house, of the corruption that is there. And so anyway, in the synoptics, they show him doing this at the end of his ministry. You'll see this in Matthew 21. Here, John is showing this event in the beginning of Christ's ministry. Now, various commentaries will give different reasons for this. And some say, of course, as commentators generally do, well, John just wanted to use this to make a theological point, that is Malachi, that Christ was supposed to come suddenly to his temple. And so they think he wrote this and took it out of its time order and put it here. I don't. Others would suggest this, that perhaps Christ, there were two occurrences, and that's what I think is more likely the case, that John wrote what they left out, and so they left out the first coming to the temple, and so he includes this in here. And I want to say this, to prove this or give evidence, the time sequence of events is incredibly important to John. He takes incredible detail. Remember that? He shows when Christ was baptized, and he tells us the hour of the day when Christ is baptized. And then he goes to, he shows Christ going to Cana for the wedding. You remember how he said this day? He names the day. Remember last time when it was the third day of the journey? It was the third day of him baptizing and getting his disciples. John is so concerned with time order, with chronology and that. Do you think for a minute he would just suddenly slip some event in there that didn't really occur? No. No. So there had to have been, I believe, two separate cases here that existed. So I think what happened was this. As Christ came to the temple and he cleansed the temple at the beginning of his ministry, and I think that this is part of what Christ's concern is, the cleanliness of his temple, the cleanliness of his father's house. And so I think the first time that he did this, he seemingly got away with it because the leadership, the religious leadership of the day, probably just took it, just sort of overlooked it, and they considered him, maybe he was impudent, but yet they didn't know who he was. Remember that? They really weren't sure. Was he the Messiah? Was he the promised prophet? Who was he? Remember how they came and they wanted to know who's who here? And so they didn't know who he was, but they knew he was, and they knew he was somebody. And so the first time, they weren't sure what was going on. Now, by the time the second occurrence happens, they knew who he was. And he had now enraged all of the leadership. They were looking for some way to get him. And I see Christ in the beginning. Remember, he was telling people, don't tell anyone who healed you. Don't tell anyone that this took place. And he was trying to downplay things and trying to keep himself kind of out of sight. But later, when it was time for his crucifixion, you almost see him pushing the buttons. You remember in Matthew, he'd say, you whitewashed sepulchers. He's just pushing their buttons. He's the whores going to the kingdom before you religious leaders. And he was just pushing on them very, very vehemently. And I think this was one of the things he did too. He went in there a second time now and cast them out the second time as a part of getting them to finally crucify him. One of the things, remember I read a book, and this is an aside here, but I remember at least thinking about this. I read a book early on in my conversion called The Passover Plot. And here were a group of Jewish people who made a case for Christ orchestrating this whole thing. And I believe that he did have a part in that. That is, he said, you know, he had a work to perform. And then he said, it is finished. But you understand, I think some Christians have this view that Christ was just going through the motions and angels and God the Father supernaturally was orchestrating, making all this happen. But no, he had a work to do. And so he said, go and get this this ass that's tied, this foal. It's tied over here. Go do this. Prepare this room. Do this. He had to orchestrate things. So I think some of this can fit into that context, that he was the one that knew when to start his ministry. He knew it had to be complete by 3 years. So he had to go slow, and then it had to accelerate further. You see what I'm getting at? I want to plant that in our minds as well, that just like we have to get ready for the feast, we have to get ready for different things that we have to do. He had to plan. He had to choose his disciples. He had to make arrangements, and he had to make certain things take place as he fulfilled prophecy. I don't think it happened without supernatural help, but on the other hand, I want us to realize that he was actively involved orchestrating many of the events as they went along. So one of the things that John does is he puts this in here because of Malachi's prophecy. And so let's go there, Malachi 3 and verse 1. This was to occur. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom you delight in. Behold, he shall come, says the Lord of hosts. And so it was understood that Christ would fulfill this prophecy of suddenly coming to his temple. He would appear there, and people would be greatly aware of it. And so John includes this first occurrence for that purpose, to make sure people understand this was, in fact, being fulfilled. And when he did this, when he came to the temple, what he saw was a virtual marketplace here, a commercial enterprise going on. John 2 and verse 14 through 17. And so he came to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the changers' money and overthrew their tables. And he said unto them that sold doves, take these things from here. Make not my Father's house a house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house has eaten me up. And so Christ came and found the area of the temple filled with commercial activity. And this was not the temple building itself, of course. The temple sat on top of Mount Zion, and there was about 30 acres in this whole area. And it basically was two parts, the temple building, and then there were walled courts surrounding the building. There were four of these courtyards extending out from the temple, each one a little wider, these courtyards. And the first one was the court of the priests, and only the priests could go in there. And this is where there were the furnishings of worship and the altar, the burnt offering, the brazen laver, and some of those things, the lampstand, altar, incense, the table, and all the showbread. And that stuff was in that inner court. Then there was an outer court that was the court of the Israelites. And here was this huge courtyard where only men, Jewish men, could go. And then there was the court of the women afterwards. We sort of have this hierarchy of importance, you see, in their day and age. There was the court of the women, and so this is as close as women were able to get to God. They could go to this courtyard and only that far. And then there was the court of the Gentiles, and it covered this vast space around the other courtyards, and it was a place of worship for only those that were Gentile converts. Now, there was this great wall, if you'll go to Ephesians, a great wall. This was huge that kept the Gentiles this far and this distance from the temple itself. And there's a scripture here in Ephesians 2 and verse 14 that refers to this wall. Sometimes people take this to think that the law is done away, but it didn't mean that at all. In verse 13 it says, but now in Christ Jesus, you who sometimes were far off are made close or nigh by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who has made both one, and has broken down the middle wall of partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself of two one new man, so making peace. So what he's talking about is making peace between Jew and Gentile. He's not talking about the laws of God as the Ten Commandments, but he's talking about a law that made a difference between Jew and Gentile. Now, this law was actually found in excavations. They found the sign that where this was written and embedded in the wall of the Gentiles. And the Zondervan Dictionary says, here's what it said. Between the court of the Gentiles and the court of the woman, there was a wall. It was a beautiful marble wall with tablets inset in the wall at various intervals. Inside the tablets was inscribed in Greek and Roman letters a warning that a foreigner could not go further in on pain of death. On these inset tablets was one of these, was discovered, and the inscription read, and this is a translation, and they had it in different languages, "Let no one of any other nation come within the fence and barrier around the holy place. Whosoever will be taken doing so will himself be responsible for the fact that his death will ensue." So that's kind of interesting, and that's a point that when you read this in Ephesians, it's not talking about the Ten Commandments, but it's talking about this law and this inscription on these tablets inset in the wall. So anyway, the marketplace was the court of the Gentiles. Here was this commercial market taking place there. And of course, people who would come to the temple to worship needed animals to sacrifice. Those were pilgrims, for instance, would sell their animals at home, and they would take their journey, and they would come to Jerusalem. Remember the scriptures on the feast? It says you're to take your animals and take your produce and you turn it into money and you go to where God has placed his name, and there you buy whatever your soul lusts after when you're keeping the feast. Well, what they would do is they would sell their sacrificial animals, bring them to Jerusalem, they would take the money, and they would buy animals to sacrifice. And so worshipers needed oxen, they needed sheep, they needed doves, and they needed incense and oil and all these different things for their offerings to God. So these guys who came from foreign nations had to exchange their money in order to buy these various animals to offer, right? So anyway, you understand that we do this today. If you go from one nation to another, you have to exchange your money. So what these guys were doing, though, is charging incredible interest rates, number one, to get the money in exchange. Number two, you can imagine this. You guys, you bring your lamb. You curry the lamb. You make sure there's not a single blemish on it. You bring it down to Jerusalem. And you go to take it to worship it, to worship and to sacrifice to God. And the priest does this. He looks over the lamb, and guess what? This lamb has a blemish. You understand, every lamb would have a blemish because you had to go to the people that sold the lambs. And then you would buy the lamb for five times the price. And so they had this scam going. So you can see, you can just imagine Christ just furious when he saw what's going on there in Jerusalem. Here these poor people, widows and others, who would want to come and bring their sacrifices, were being ripped off by these leaders here. And so they were charging for, it was like a half a shekel for every shekel that they exchanged into their own money. Then they actually charged you a half a shekel for every shekel in change they gave you, if you can imagine that. But anyway, it was a terrible ripoff. And so anyway, a vast amount of wealth was accumulated by this tax. Some people have said that between the temple tax and these other funds, there was about $225,000 a year from this going on. Massive amounts of time when you consider money, when you consider the time that this occurred. There's a guy named Crassus who was captured Jerusalem in 54 BC, and he raided the temple treasury, and it says this, that he took $7,500,000 and still did not exhaust the temple treasury. Imagine those guys having that kind of money and still doing this kind of thing instead of giving the money back to the poor. And it makes you think, too, sometimes. You remember Paul when he was taking up offerings for the brethren at Jerusalem? I'm sure Jerusalem had so much money that the rich there, the leadership, had that money. And yet the church had to help others. That's typical of what we do. So this is the kind of thing that enraged Christ. They were fleecing the pilgrims there, and they just couldn't afford it. It was a terrible social injustice, and it was being done in the name of religion. And this inflamed him to intense anger, and it took away from the awe of God. You imagine this about the, you go into the temple, you want to worship God, and what do you hear? You hear all the mooing, you hear all the braying, you hear the noises of the sheep, the baaing of the sheep, you hear all that, you hear the haggling of people over money, and all of the smells and all of the rest of it that would go on with this. Can't you see how that would take away from the awe of God, from the reverence? I mean, the whole thing became kind of a circus there. And so you can see again the rattle of coins, the shouts of the hucksters and so on, and the arguing over price, and all of this made it almost impossible for the Gentiles to pray or worship God at all. And so he comes into this area and he just sees the activity going on. He sees the spirit there, and it probably made him very angry. And so he watched quietly, just watched it all going on. And then he made a little whip, and then he used it to drive out all of these animals and the people. John, back to John 2. This time in verse 15. And when he made a scourge, small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and oxen, and poured the changers' money out and overthrew the tables, and said, "This is my Father's house. Don't make it a house of merchandise." And so he made this scourge of small cords. It was a little whip made from twisted rushes and reeds, probably. But it was at least an emblem of authority in one sense. There's no evidence here that he used it on men. But he did not come to judge men at this time. And then it says that he cast them out. And this is the very same word that was used elsewhere in the Bible where it said that Jesus Christ cast out demons. So he cast out the animals, the merchandise, from where it was in a similar method or means. And he poured out the changer's money. And something it shows to me is the contempt Christ has for money and religion. And this has been something that's always been something that bugged me. You notice that you see this today. It seems to be at the bottom of almost every act of men. Most people will say, follow the money, you know, to see who's guilty and what the truth is in some matter. But money or power, it just is what seems to motivate so many of us more than truth. And so he overthrew these tables, showing his displeasure. And throwing out, I think, the whole mess of it. So in verse 16, and he said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my Father's house a house of merchandise. And that's something I think we should never do, and yet I've seen that happen so many times, merchandising as it was. Remember 1 Samuel 8 and verse 3, his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes and perverted judgment. You understand why I say this? People that get into religious positions will do this frequently. I've actually known people that use the principle of third tithe to control people. There are religious guys that would take pieces of the money that they'd give people money in the church and they'd get a kickback from it. You understand what I mean? That whenever you have money like that, it's just something that it just twists people, I guess, so many times. Anyway, remember when Naaman came to God's prophet to be healed, and he expected to pay, and Elijah wouldn't let him pay, and so he then later sent his servant back to pay him, and Elijah actually turned him leprous. And that's the point. You understand what I'm getting at, is you don't mix money with the things of God, and this is why we don't charge for literature. We don't try to build a financial base. There was one guy that came to visit with us, and he attended for a while, and he was trying to convince me that I needed to invest our tithe money in some money-making scheme where he said I could double the money every month. You know, and boy, that would really sound good, wouldn't it? Imagine doubling your money every month. But you know it's a scam. And so anyway, my point is people will do this and try to mix money and mix religion. So Isaiah 56, 11. Yes, they're greedy dogs, which can never have enough. They're shepherds that cannot understand. They all look to their own way, and everyone to their own gain. Tell me that doesn't apply to televangelism today. It has to. And you know, have we changed any? You see, it's the same thing. So Jeremiah 6, from the least of them even to the greatest of every one of them is given to covetousness, and from the prophet even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. Remember Simon Magus? I'll give you money. Give me the power of the Holy Spirit. Why? So I can make more money, you see. So anyway, it's the whole of human nature to use God to make money. And when we do that, we so cheapen what God is, and we so cheapen what worship of God should be, and we trivialize what is holy. And God help us for doing such a thing, and God help them. And you can see Christ's anger. You can just see how furious he was. The merchants wail when Babylon's brought down, and Babylon should be brought down. But what do they care about? It's just the money. So anyway, these guys had turned the temple area into a marketplace. You guys remember Reseda, the Reseda congregation? There are about 300 people there. And do you remember us having fundraiser meetings and stuff on the Sabbath? Anybody remember the script program? No? I used to watch in horror. Here we are, the Church of God, keeping his Sabbath, but we want to make money. And this is good. And some of the pastors would turn in money that they made from fundraisers to headquarters, and that looked good for them, you know. So what we did was they had script. You understand what script is? You get a piece of the, you know, for everything you spend, you get a certain piece is sent to your church or something. And so they would have meetings on the Sabbath to figure out who's doing what and who's going to be head of this and who's going to be head of that and how we're going to do this. We did this many times. All I could think of was this, over and over and over again. And even in the apostasy that we experienced, what happened was the church was so cohesive and was a subculture that it was a beautiful thing. And the new young leaders coming into this, they thought in their minds, and I was privy to people and had conversations with people in meetings, so I know what I'm saying is really true, because I talked to people who were actually there. And the view really was behind the scenes that if we could just strip this church of its cult-like teachings, why, we would have people wanting to flock to the church. We'd grow so big, we'd have real power. And behind it all really was money. They thought they'd have more money. But you understand what's happened. God has just corrupted them, destroyed them. And there was one case where the guy who was in charge of the money was on the stage crying on his hands and knees, with tears coming down his face, crying because they didn't have enough money to pay their bills. So they went from $200 million a year to $30 million a year. And of course, I wouldn't mind $30 million, but the point I make is that, you know, it's always going to end up like that. It may not seem like it. It all may seem like it's going well. Remember the Tammy and who was that other guy? Tammy Baker and Jim Baker, and they were going to make this Heritage USA or something, some grand theme park, religious theme park, and it's always, you get bigger and bigger and more powerful, and it collapses on you. And you also get into dirty dealings, and that's what was going on here. And something I bring out because it's something we want to make sure we keep away from in every single respect. No reverence for God in a church like that, you understand? Anyway. And to think about where we are here. Verse 17. Anyway, his disciples remembered that it was written, "The zeal of thine house has eaten me up." And there's something about this that is, I think, fairly exciting. I love people that have zeal. I think everybody does. Really on fire, a passion about them, about their work, about their love of God. About their love of their family. You love people that are passionate about good and right things. And anyway, he quoted Psalm 69, if you want to put that in there, if it isn't already in your margin. But the zeal for God's house means that he had an intense ardor, an extraordinary concern for the temple of God, and that his desire was that the worship there be pure, that it be approved of by God. And so when he says it's eaten me up, it means that it just absorbed him. It was his, had his entire attention. It surpassed all other feelings that he had. Let's go to Hebrews 3 for a minute, because I want to bring out a parallel here. Hebrews 3. in verse 5 and 6, Moses verily was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken after. But Christ as a son over his own house, whose house are we if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end? And so you understand my point, that I think that we need to realize that we are God's house, and that how does he look at us and how does he view us? And shouldn't we be careful about the things that we talk about the things we engage in, the kind of meetings we might have, for instance, perhaps talking about what we're going to be doing tomorrow or making plans during God's holy day on the Sabbath. You see what I mean? Even that, I think we get on the edge sometimes. I don't think we go over at this point, but I'm just saying it's something to be concerned about. Realize how much concern Jesus had for his house, and if we're his house, then we should have that same kind of attitude that Jesus did. Remember that it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Can you see for a minute Christ with this little whip, the power and force that he exhibited in that outer temple area? What's it going to be like when he comes back with all the power in the universe and he's angry? I mean, it's just a small indicator, isn't it? What the anger he is going to have on Babylon the Great. So anyway, he's not to be mocked, I think, is my point here. I want us to read Psalm 50, if you will. Could it be that we could forget God, that we could forget this other side of him, that we deeply appreciate his grace, we deeply love him for his goodness, for his blessings, and we forget that there is a side of God that is a side that can be his fury? But he says this in verse 16. I want to read through 23, just by way of reminder that we shouldn't cross God. We can't think we can just keep putting him off. We can't think, and I think that was a good sermon you gave. I remember when you said about your son and how he keeps saying, well, I'm sorry, see, that he wants us to change. If we think we can just play God along and we can do things that were unseen, we're not going to get away with it forever. And he says this here, verse 16 through 23, but unto the wicked God says, what have you to do to declare my statutes, or that you should take my covenant in your mouth, seeing that you hate instruction, and you cast my words behind you? So what about people that are preaching God's truth? What about these people that are using the Bible to make money and build a power base and a grand, vast audience and have beautiful cars and homes, and that's what's driving and motivating them? But they really hate his word. They hate his law. And then he said, when you saw a thief and you consented with him, and you've been partakers with adulterers. Now look, you saw a thief and consented with him. Do you think for a minute that there aren't people in religious organizations that know someone's skimming and not saying anything about it? Do you think there were priests that knew about the pedophilia that was going on and didn't say anything about it? They knew about it, and they consented by not bringing it to somebody's attention. Then you have been a partaker with adulterers, he said. And you give your mouth to evil, and your tongue frames deceit. You sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's son, that is within families. You badmouth one another. Friendly fire is what I call it. People today will attack others in other churches, mock and ridicule and make fun of others. Yet we're all in the same family. These things have you done, he says, and I kept silent. You thought that I was altogether one such as yourself. But I'll reprove you and set them in order before your eyes. Now consider this, you that forget God, lest I tear you in pieces and there be none to deliver. So you get the point. There's another side to God. We don't mock him. We don't play him along and be hypocrites and say one thing, preach his word, and then live some other way that's vile in his eyes. So he's coming to the earth soon, and we ought to remember this side of his wrath, that we are his house today. And if we lack the proper respect for God and awe for him, and we aren't striving to be clean and holy, he had the power, the authority to cleanse the temple then, and he will come back, and he will cleanse his temple all over again when he returns. I want you to think about this in another perspective. Money changers out. And no one seemed to oppose him. Well, why do you think that would be? Can you imagine this? What if some stranger would just went in? You know, they'd call security. Everybody would just attack, wouldn't they? You'd think, well, why didn't that take place here? I think there's a number of reasons I just want to pass over for a minute. I think those men knew what they were doing was wrong. I think when he first went in there, their conscience bothered him. They knew what they were doing was wrong. Secondarily, in their culture, they had the greatest, deepest respect for a prophet. And I believe that they thought Christ very well could have been a prophet. He certainly acted like one, didn't he? He spoke with authority, and he did those things that were righteous. And he acted like a messenger of God. And I think those people were just flat out afraid to oppose someone who could have been a prophet of God. Remember, he, number three, already had a reputation among the people. There was John's testimony. He was the prophet that it was to come. And now he had disciples following him. And so they could have thought, in all likelihood, maybe this guy is the Messiah. We better not mess with him. We don't know yet. But also, Christ had a power over people. You can see that in his teaching and in his manner, the way he spoke with authority and so on. They would come out to see him, and people would follow him, literally going all day without food even. And so remember, too, when the people came out to take Christ, you remember this? He looks at them, and he speaks a word, and they all fall back. So he must have had a presence. You ever notice that some men have a presence? You just know that they're pretty important people by the way they carry themselves. So you can almost feel it, can't you? Imagine the presence God on earth would have had. He looks and speaks, and people fall down. I'm sure this man was a pretty imposing figure there. When this took place. So anyway, Christ cleansed the temple at the outset of his ministry, and I think they didn't resist because of their conscience convicted them in the demeanor and authority that he had. He spoke as a prophet, and I think they feared he might indeed be the Messiah. And then 3 years later, it happened all over again. And again, it teaches us a great lesson that human nature will want to turn things to gain for self. And what we want to do is learn from this example and not taint our services, nor taint our homes with things that are defiling. So he came in wrath in the beginning of his ministry. He came in wrath at the end of his ministry. And he's coming in wrath again at the end of the age. And there's lessons for all of us here not to misuse things that are the things of God. Luke 24 and verse 51. It came to pass, while he blessed them, that he was parted from them and carried up into heaven. This is Christ leaving now at the very end. And they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they were continually in the temple praising and blessing God. So you understand why I read this. He's left now and gone to heaven. And we should then spend our time as we worship God, praising him and worshiping him with great joy. Not in an attitude of how great we are or what we can get out of it, whether it's recognition needs or whatever it might be. Ecclesiastes 5:1 says this, "Keep your foot when you go into the house of God and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil." Do you understand what that's really saying? Don't trample, don't step on, walk all over my Sabbath. Don't trample on it. And don't go into services giving the sacrifice of fools. What is the sacrifice of a fool? They don't realize they do evil. They don't go in humbly to learn. As you've seen, people have visited us for what purpose? Oh, to try to teach us something, to try to show us that we're wrong. That kind of thing is really what went on. They don't go in going, "I need to learn. I'm weak. I have problems." You understand? We're not foolish when we go to church to be taught, to be corrected, to be instructed. That's how we should go in. That's the attitude we should have when we go into God's house, as says. But in our world today, in many, many churches, even I say in churches of God, that when people get up to lead songs, they get up to give prayers, there might be some sweat on their palms, a little nervousness. But is that nervousness because they fear God or because they fear what people might think or they might slip up here or there? You understand what I'm saying? That we've become a people who have advertised God like Pepsi Cola. We've got the TV evangelists and all of that. And all their prancing and dancing and sequin jackets and all of their fancy gold gilded stages, you see, emphasizes them. And it doesn't emphasize God. And in so doing, we've built a whole society that trivializes God. I think Donald McCullough said it very well when he wrote this. The New Testament warns us, offer to God an acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for indeed our God is a consuming fire. But reverence and awe have often been replaced by a yawn of familiarity. The consuming fire has been domesticated into a candle flame. Oh, adding a bit of religious atmosphere perhaps, but no real heat, no blinding light, no purifying fire. And then he says, when the true story gets told, whether in the partial light of historical perspective, or in the perfect light of eternity, it may well be revealed that the worst sin of the church at the end of the 20th century has been the trivialization of God. And I don't want that to happen to any one of us. So he is a flaming fire. We see the power. We see the side of his anger when he goes in and cleanses the temple. And he de-leavens his house. And he's coming back. And he's going to once again de-leaven his house, which is us. And so what we want to do is de-leaven ourselves, I guess you might say, in preparation for his return, so that we face him with joy and thanksgiving and don't face his wrath.